Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing fine, Justin.
Awesome.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
A couple of notes. I recently interviewed Mike Morford. He was someone that we had on in the past to talk about the Zodiac Killer, the canonical view, and that just means the accepted view. I interviewed him about the Golden State Killer. He spoke about it at CrimeCon, and now he has his own podcast, Criminology. Listen to the interview on Patreon. If you're a Patreon supporter at the subscription plus level or above, you can hear that interview. Also, we've been neglecting this, but Justin and I are having a big meetup in October to celebrate the 5th anniversary of the show that happened in June. And it's happening when and where, Justin?
It's October 14th at 1 p.m. at the Buffalo Room, or the Westport Flea Market.
If you listen to the Robert Burdella episode, The Butcher of Kansas City, you probably heard of this place. And if you live in Kansas City, you may have already been there before. So hopefully you will head out and see us there.
Yep. Sounds good.
And for those of you that show up, well, some of you might be getting free stuff.
Prizes, swag, whatever we've accumulated over the years. We're going to bring it. And we will be unveiling a new shirt design that night.
And some of you will be getting one.
Tonight's case is a local one to us. It was a Kansas City case. It's something that spilled out into the media and into the public. I remember seeing billboards about this and it kind of encompassing the city, or anyone that was in the know will remember this. So what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight we're talking about the murder of Ali Kemp, who was a 19-year-old honor student who had just finished her first year at Kansas State University and was working at her community pool when she was murdered. Ali is her nickname. That's how friends and family knew her. She was born Alexandra Kemp. Her father was Roger, her mother, Kathy, and she had 2 brothers. As I said, she was a great student. She attended Blue Valley North High School and was involved in sports, basketball, soccer, and volleyball. And she volunteered a lot of time at both church and school. at the time in question, which was June 18th, 2002 in Leawood, Kansas, she had just finished her first year at Kansas State University, where she was majoring in mass communications. On this day, she had worked at the pool, and sometime that afternoon, around 3 o'clock, she called a friend and said, "Hey, would you mind coming by here and hanging out with me? Keep me company." And her friend replied, "Sure." And then she called her boyfriend, although her boyfriend didn't pick up. Her friend Laurel had just been at the doctor's office, and she was coming back and was going to stop by the pool. And the pool was just blocks from Allie's home. And when she got there, she didn't see her friend. Allie was nowhere to be found, but, you know, her stuff was there. So she said, you know, the only thing that she saw a man leaving. And they sort of looked at each other. And she had said that the man looked like he was possibly a maintenance worker of some kind because he was wearing a uniform. So she leaves. That was at 3:15. At 5 p.m., Tyler Kemp, who's 17 years old, Allie's brother, and he arrived at the community pool to start his shift. But, well, when he does that, he's used to seeing Allie. So Allie will leave.
They're supposed to hand off each, you know, the shift. If anything's going on, she can inform him, whatever. It's the shift change.
They're pool attendants. But he's very concerned because this is just not normal. Laurel said that she thought that Allie had left, you know, all of a sudden, maybe to go across the street to the convenience store or something. For Tyler, no, this isn't right. And he called his dad. And his dad, Roger, was very, very concerned and headed right over to help him look. Roger went in the pool house. Now, the pool house is where the pump room is and pool supplies are. Tyler had already gone in there once, but didn't see anything. Roger went in, and I guess you could say he was more thorough in his search, and he ended up lifting up a piece of tarp because he saw a leg sticking out. And underneath was the mostly nude body of his daughter, Allie. And it was very clear that she had suffered a brutal attack. So he put his hand down to check her temperature, and her back still had some warmth to it, and he was hoping they could save her. He shouted for his son to call 911. It wasn't very long before paramedics got into that pool room, and they ended up whisking Allie off to the hospital. Unfortunately, because she had suffered such a brutal attack, she was pronounced dead upon arrival.
This is the most horrifying thing that a father can probably come across. This is something that just doesn't happen in that area at all. It's a very well-to-do area. I spend a lot of time in that area for work. So this is out of the ordinary, not something that ever happens in Leawood, Kansas.
And this is one of the reasons why we're covering this case, is because it's that, how could that happen here kind of thing. This just isn't expected. It's supposed to be a safe place. Detective Joe Langer, he arrived. He saw the results of what had happened to Allie. His aim now is to get the perpetrator of this crime. The police take down the names of everyone there. One of the people there is a man who gives his name as Teddy Hoover.
And Teddy arrives hours later and sees all this commotion and decides to check out what's going on. And that's when he gets questioned by police.
Allie, as I said, was taken to the hospital. Laurel, her friend, heard that she was taken to the hospital, heard that she had been attacked, and she went to the hospital. There was nothing she could do. Allie had been pronounced dead. She did go and speak with a policeman and talk to him about the man she had seen. Teddy Hoover kind of stands out because he has a story for why he was there, but it's odd. He's a pool maintenance person, and he has his own business. His story is that he was at the pool that day because he wanted to possibly take on that community pool as a client. So he would actually take care of the maintenance, the treatment, and care of the pool.
Also, it appears that he showed up after the attack. It's when they were questioning people. He rolls up in his truck. So not exactly a prime suspect, because it seems apparent that he wasn't there before.
But he's saying he went there to possibly take on a client.
Yeah.
The police have gathered evidence. Forensics has identified DNA at the scene of the crime and on Allie Kemp's clothing that does not belong to Allie. And they believe that this other DNA may belong to the killer. So eventually the police want to speak with Teddy Hoover and just see if he'll submit a DNA sample so they can either rule him out or include him as a suspect. They go and visit Teddy Hoover, and he doesn't want to give up a DNA sample. He said that he wanted to speak to his lawyer, and then he would talk to them. The police don't really have much of a choice, so they leave it at that. But they don't hear back from him, so they attempt to reach out again, only they can't find him.
And there's nobody registered with that name, no trace of anyone named Teddy Hoover.
But they do know the name of his lawyer, so they speak with Teddy Hoover's lawyer. He told the police that, well, he's gone. Teddy Hoover left town. That's not good. They wanted to get a DNA sample, and they were hoping to get one. But now, not only do they not know really who he is, but they don't know where he went to. And the lawyer knew Teddy Hoover's real identity, but did not disclose it to the police.
So the police have a dead lead, and they can no longer pursue it, and they have to go for other avenues. But they really don't have many of those.
Yeah, in fact, I don't know of any other ones other than there could have been someone who entered the pool house and attacked Allie Kemp and then left, and they don't know who that is. An autopsy was performed by Dr. Michael Handler. According to his findings, Allie had fought her attacker the best she could. Her left index and middle fingers were broken. Her eyes were blackened. Her lips were cut, as were her fingers, and her hips, knees, feet, and thighs were bruised. There were also lacerations to the back of her head. So she suffered a violent beating, and in addition to that, there was evidence of both manual and ligature strangulation. I think at this point, the police have just Teddy Hoover. That's it. And they really want to figure out, you know, who Teddy Hoover is.
They do have something. They have a description of a man. That's the only thing they have to go on. And a description of a pickup truck. So what do they do with that?
Well, that comes via Laurel, Allie's friend. And she was able to describe the man that she saw. And a composite sketch was drawn based on her information. Now, the police, I don't know what they plan to do with this composite sketch, but in February of 2003, Roger Kemp, her father, he did not want to just let things take their course. He wanted to be involved. And he came up with this brilliant idea armed with this composite sketch that was drawn up. He went to Lamar Advertising. And of course, many of you have probably passed billboards driving down highways or streets. And Lamar is a big name in billboards. So he went and spoke with someone named Bob Fessler. And he told him about his idea. He said, you know, obviously you've seen the news. My daughter's been murdered. I want to find her killer. And I believe that if we put this composite sketch up with a phone number and ask for tips, that the public will respond. Well,
and he was trying to find out how much it would cost to rent a billboard out.
Yeah, he wanted to get one or two billboards. I mean, we don't know how, he didn't know how much it was going to cost. So he's saying, I'll take one or two, but it depends on the cost. Lamar Advertising refuses his money and says, we'll just donate it to you. So don't worry about it. They love the idea, and this is a way for them to help out. They estimate that about 50,000 pairs of eyes went past this billboard every day. And leads were generated. I think in the first couple of weeks or so, they had about 150 tips. The great thing is, two tips were called in that claimed to know the man's true identity, the man that was shown on the billboard in the sketch. And one of the tips even directed the police to where the man had gone to. So you're talking about jackpot, this brilliant, I called it a clever idea. It's just something that, I mean, as far as I know, hadn't really been done before, had it, Justin?
Not on this scale. I had seen billboards where they'll post a picture of, say, a victim and say, wanted, the killer of my son or daughter, but to post a sketch of the suspect. No, I'd never seen anything like that.
We've always seen where people had wanted posters or missing posters, and they would distribute them around to different restaurants or convenience stores. But this is a billboard where a lot of traffic goes past it. It pays off in a way that I don't think Roger Kemp could have ever dreamed. Now, the new information they get is that Teddy Hoover is not Teddy Hoover, but someone by the name of Benjamin Appleby, who in 2002 was 29 years old and did clean pools for a living.
So we have a name of a man who supposed to be at the pool. And if they are able to find pictures of this Appleby, they'll notice that he has a striking resemblance to the composite sketch.
Yeah, he's kind of a stocky guy. In fact, he used to wrestle. So that would maybe give you an idea of his build, of the way he holds himself. Now, where he had gone to was he had been living with a girlfriend in Bantam, Connecticut.
Ex-girlfriend, but who's really keeping track?
Well, if they're living together, you wonder.
Yeah.
So what Connecticut police do is they're in contact with Kansas detectives, and they're being told, hey, we think this guy might be responsible for a murder back in Kansas. And so they kind of coordinate for the Kansas detectives to come out to Connecticut.
And he happens to have a warrant out for his arrest for other offenses. It's not that hard for law enforcement to get a hold of Connecticut and say, hey, we need you to get this guy and hold him until we get there.
Yeah, his outstanding warrant stems from either 1997 or 1998. It wasn't really clear from all of the sources I was looking at. It involved risk of injury, disorderly conduct, public indecency. A few charges to give you an idea of what he was being accused of at the time.
It said that he would masturbate in public and assault and try to rob people.
In 1992, he was charged with first degree robbery and armed criminal action. 1993, second degree robbery and second degree burglary. 94, sexual misconduct. In 1996, indecent exposure, which was public masturbation. One of these robberies occurred across the street from a police station at a convenience store.
It's a real smart guy here.
I don't even know what to say to that. Certainly, that's his past. Apparently, at one of these robberies, he also had a weapon that he placed up against the head of someone at the store and pulled the trigger, and it didn't fire. And according to Appleby, it wasn't loaded. So I'm sure he thought nothing of it, but I can only imagine the terror of having a weapon placed against your head and hearing that click. So possibly a violent individual and someone who has shown
a history of violence.
And this is the person who they're now honing in on as possibly being Allie Kemp's killer. So the Connecticut police have picked him up and they're speaking with him about these other charges. And then during this time, Benjamin Appleby is asking if he can get a lawyer.
He pretty much just says, will I get a chance to call my lawyer? And they say, yeah, definitely. And then later on, he'll say, will I be able to talk to my lawyer soon? And they keep assuring him, totally. Yeah, no problem. But once they pass him over to the Kansas authorities, they ask him, are you willing to talk to us without a lawyer present? And he agrees.
He has read his Miranda rights, but he essentially waives them by saying he doesn't need a lawyer present to speak to the police. And I think this all comes down... this willingness is happening because he had spoken with his mother. His mother was telling him, we can't afford a good lawyer. You just need to cooperate and maybe you'll get to go home. So, you know, we've heard about other cases where the police say, yeah, if you cooperate, you'll be out of here. Don't worry about it. Right, Justin?
Yeah, they are really sneaky about their ways of getting you to talk. I make no bones about that. And sure, they can say, yeah, you're going to get a chance to talk to your lawyer, no problem. But once they read you the Miranda rights, I personally think it's up to you to keep your mouth shut and to invoke that Fifth Amendment right. But if you don't, that's on you. And so he decides to talk to the police, and I'm glad he did. I'm glad he cooperated.
Yeah, he's 30 years old. His mother is telling him they can't get a good lawyer. She further disses the public, the court-appointed lawyers, by stating, you know what'll happen if you get a court-appointed lawyer. So just cooperate and maybe you can go home. That's what Benjamin wants. He wants to get out of there. So he decides to cooperate with the police. And by cooperate, I mean he talks to them without a lawyer present. And apparently he never tells the Kansas detectives that he wants a lawyer. He says, no, I'll talk to you right now. It'll be fine.
So there he goes. And he gives them pretty much a full confession and describes how this goes down, how he was watching Allie. He was attracted to her. And when she walked into the pool room, the shop room, he followed her in there. And as he puts it, made a pass at her or hit on her. And she rejected him. And when she tried to leave, he blocked her passage and continued to engage her. And when she continued to reject him, that's when he got physical with her.
When Appleby told the detectives about this, he kept rubbing his forearms and he seemed rather nervous. And he said that he just lost it, that he was so upset by her rejection that he just started hitting her. He takes her down and then continues to beat on her. While Allie tried her best to fight back, he just literally beat the hell out of her and then started strangling her. Part of the autopsy revealed, and this is something that would be disputed later by the defense, but part of the autopsy talked about how her strangulation took between 10 to 16 minutes to complete. This is something that's probably uneasy to hear, but if someone is strangled, it can take them 2 to 3 minutes to die. And with Benjamin Appleby not having any kind of experience with this, it's believable that he strangled her for a minute or so and then let up and then realized that she was still breathing and then had to do it again and again and again until she finally died. And this is just painting a picture of how much Allie Kemp suffered at the hands of Benjamin Appleby.
He also goes on to say that once she's unconscious, he disrobes her and then goes to a first aid kit to get lubricant, which is some ointment or antibiotic or something that he can use to come back and rape her. But he is unable to. And so he leaves her and decides to pull the tarp over her body because he doesn't want to leave her exposed where people can see her. So he's confessed to the assault. He's confessed to an attempted rape and the murder of Allie Kemp.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens,
It's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Appleby was arrested November 8th of 2004. And on November 9th, Benjamin Appleby was charged with first-degree murder. Now, we had talked about how the tips poured in, and two of those tips led to the capture of Benjamin Appleby. The two tipsters who had provided the information would share the reward money. The reward money was $50,000. The tipster who gave the information of the identity of Teddy Hoover, the real identity, as well as where he was, got the lion's share of the reward money, which was $40,000. But he refused it. He wanted that money to go to a scholarship fund that the Kemp family started in Allie's name.
That's cool.
Which is pretty awesome, I think. The remaining $10,000 went to the tipster who gave information on who Teddy Hoover was as well. At trial, Benjamin Appleby, you know, it's clear that he confessed. But his attorney isn't going to let him just get chewed up and spit out. And so he mounts a defense around Benjamin Appleby having issues. He talked about his childhood, the house he grew up in, how there were issues there, criminal issues within the household, how he was abandoned, how he was abused. He also went on to describe Benjamin Appleby as suffering from intermittent explosive disorder, which is he would get into a rage and pretty much disassociate, not realize what he was doing. That sort of accounts for his behavior, they say, at the pool house with Allie, that being rejected by her just set him off. And so he wasn't fully in control. That's not something that really flies. And we've had many discussions on the show about mental illness. I will leave it to you to ponder this question. This guy had a record. You could ask yourself, is the record explainable by his mental illness? That he's just not fully in control, and that's why he masturbated in public, and that's why he robbed a convenience store across the street from a police station? Is he suffering from something where he just does these things and has no accountability? Or is there something else going on here? In other words, was he pushed in this direction?
I feel that he seems to be fairly in control with his pool business and other things. And after the attack, I mean, he had enough sense to use a fake name when questioned and then change his name and move away, knowing what he's done is wrong. So even if there wasn't that much premeditation there, there definitely was a lot of post cover-up of this crime. So I don't really have much sympathy for him or feel that he blacked out and committed this. I feel that he was in control, and his behavior, he has a pattern here, and it's not anything to do with him not being in control of himself.
The prosecution, they hit hard upon the reasoning for their first degree murder, which involves premeditation. Premeditation for them was that he had to go back again and again to strangle Allie Kemp. When Benjamin Appleby confessed, he had talked about how he strangled her with something. He just doesn't remember what. He said there was something there in the room that he used, but he doesn't recall. The prosecution painted this picture of him going back again and again to strangle her until she basically died. As we know, when Roger Kemp got there, she was barely clinging on because she had suffered head trauma. She had been strangled. She had suffered horribly. The jury was shown a videotape of Benjamin Appleby's confession. He was talking to Kansas detectives, and he had told them how he went to the pool to check it out as a potential client and described the entire incident of saying that he was attracted to her and hit on her. But the confession part, where he says, "I killed her. I strangled her, I guess. I don't know what I used. There was something laying there." The defense, they had to admit, yeah, he did commit this murder, but it wasn't premeditated. So again, they're trying to protect their client. And they say that Benjamin Appleby, despite his attack on her, believed she was still alive when he left and had no reason to believe that she was necessarily going to die. So they're trying to get him away from this first degree murder. But the DA, Paul Morrison, he said that Benjamin Appleby went into that room intending to have sex with Allie Kemp. And because she rejected him and because she fought him, that's why he murdered her. And I think that's a very good argument. And this is why, because of, and this will be dealt with when we talk about the appeal, but the DA argued that under Kansas law, that this first degree murder charge applied because the murder happened during an attempted rape. And they had asked for the death penalty. They wanted Benjamin Appleby put to death for this heinous crime. Kansas still has it, has the death penalty. The defense lawyer obviously wants to save their client, and they wanted the charge reduced to second degree because, again, they didn't think Benjamin Appleby left her knowing she was going to die. They said that Benjamin Appleby left thinking that Allie was going to live. But I find this a little preposterous because we know that people are killed because they're a witness. So he's just going to attempt to rape her and then beat her and strangle her, and he doesn't want her to die. I'm having a real problem swallowing that.
Yeah, just the attempted strangulation alone is enough for me to realize that he's lying and he intended to murder her.
And the defense disputes the multiple strangulation attempts, but I'm going to side with the forensics on this and just say, you know, the autopsy showed that she had petechial hemorrhaging in her eyes. She was manually, which means with the hands, and strangled by ligature, which means there was probably some kind of a rope or something that was used around her neck. So attempted strangulation multiple times. This is something that he had to go back and do again and again to try and get rid of his witness. So really, the trial comes down to 3 hours, not even 3 hours, because that's how long the jury's out before they come back and say, "We have a verdict, Your Honor." So the trial really came down to a question of, was he in control? Did he have premeditation here? Premeditation, another factor of that was the rape.
He took the time to go and find the first aid kit and try to find lubricant and then come back and attempt the rape, but was unable to. But this is all in his confession, so we know it happened. We know that there's a first aid kit there. All these things add up. Any deliberation can equate to premeditation.
Appleby is found guilty of first-degree murder and given 50 years in prison. And that's a hard 50. He has to serve 50 years before he can be released. This is part of the sentencing phase. He is also sentenced to 228 months concurrently for the attempted rape of Allie Kemp. His defense tried to spare him a long sentence. They tried to reduce it in some way.
Yeah, they're just playing damage control there.
What it is they're aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Well, for them, the mitigating circumstances were just what I told you about. He had a bad childhood. He has mental illness. Now, for the prosecution, though, they're aggravating circumstances. And what they said was, there was infliction of mental anguish or physical abuse before the victim's death, and there were continuous acts of violence before and continuing after the killing. So in other words, as I described, she had been strangled and beaten severely for some time. So it wasn't just a one punch. It wasn't a couple of punches. Appleby, he appealed his sentence. And one of the issues he had, Justin, of course, was that he says he had asked for a lawyer and that they didn't get him his lawyer.
Yeah, this is a big part of his appeal in trying to get his confession suppressed. He says that he had invoked his Fifth Amendment right and the police did not honor that. I know that they have their sneaky ways to get people to talk. I know that sometimes they won't allow people to call a lawyer in a timely fashion or whatever the case, but it has to be pretty egregious for me to feel that the cops are doing something wrong. But when they simply ask him, would you like to talk to us? And he agrees. I don't see him invoking his Fifth Amendment right very much there. They also are going on a double jeopardy clause, saying that if I understand this correctly, it's the attempted rape and the murder. But then they're using the attempted rape during the course of the murder to give him the death penalty. And they're saying, well, that's double jeopardy. You can't charge him twice for that, which it's a technicality. And it's not the best argument in my mind because that's how the law works. They piece together everything you did and use it against you. That's just the way they prosecute. His defense also takes issue with the out-of-process procedure they use to test the DNA, proving that it was him at the scene. Not that we really needed it because he gave a full confession, but they're saying that the process that the DNA was collected and then tested was a little odd, and so therefore it should be suppressed. But it wasn't unlawful. It wasn't anything extremely out of the ordinary. It was just not the standard procedure that they normally take. So all of his appeals are really based on technicalities, which obviously most appeals are based on technicalities, but they're not anything. There's no smoking gun here of, oh, gotcha, they did something wrong, or, oh, this guy was railroaded. No, he didn't invoke his Fifth Amendment right. And that's on him. And they have the DNA evidence there, and it matches him. And he avoided and evaded law enforcement to not give them DNA evidence. So I'm not feeling any kind of sympathy for this murderer and his legal defense team. They're just throwing everything at the wall and seeing what'll stick. I had to read through tons of legal documents to just even understand his appeals, and before I just facepalmed and said, whatever, dude.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Well, his appeal went all the way to the Kansas Supreme Court, and they ruled in his favor on one issue, and that was the attempted rape. Because that attempted rape had been used to basically secure his first-degree conviction and sentence, it's double jeopardy to use it to give him additional time, even if it's running concurrently. So they said that the 228 months comes off. But it doesn't change his time because he was in there for, he was given 50 years hard time. And so he will be put away for quite some time.
He'll be well into his 80s when he's released.
Yeah, he'll be 81 when he can be released. I had mentioned that Roger Kemp and his family had started a scholarship fund in Allie's name. They also started a national organization known as TakeDefense.org that offers self-defense classes to women at no charge. And what is it, like well over 10,000 women have taken these courses?
It's a huge amount.
And this is what I find interesting is they always say, you know, you can't really prepare for this stuff. But their idea is they wish that Allie had better tools to fight her attacker, to give her a fighting chance. And I know not everyone will agree with that, but I think it's excellent that the family has used this tragedy to attempt to help others around the country. Roger Kemp's campaign to use billboards to catch a killer, well, it caught on in other states.
Absolutely, it did. Now I see it a lot more in Kansas City, too.
Yeah, there are other states that have been using billboards to catch killers. Really interesting, because they said that if you put something out on the news, let's say you put something on the 5 o'clock news that says, hey, we're looking for this killer. Here's a picture or a sketch. Let us know if you see anything. Call this hotline. You have to be sitting there watching the show at that time, or have it recorded and go back and watch it. The great thing about the billboard idea is, you know, like if they put a billboard up on 435, Justin, and you're taking 435 every day, you'll see that every day. And if you have any information that you think is relevant, now you can make a phone call, because not only do you see this very large sketch, but then you see a phone number next to it that's really easy to memorize.
I'm surprised that it hasn't been used as much. It's not that it was an original idea, but it really caught on because of this case. I remember seeing these billboards every day. Other situations or other murders and whatnot in Kansas City, there was the Precious Doe. There was Crystal Kipper. There was just a number of murders and missing people that had happened. And they took advantage of the billboards. So, but this was probably the biggest, I don't know what you call the push for finding a murderer using public publications.
Finding a killer, finding justice for a family, that's something we can all relate to, even if we haven't lost someone to a killer. If you're driving down the road and you see something like this, it catches your attention. I don't know about you, Justin, but I mean, if I'm driving down the road, I'd much rather see something that allows me to help if I can, rather than just an advertisement for, say, a country music tour.
I would prefer to feel like I'm doing something good for society and not consuming.
And I said that about 50,000 pairs of eyes were going past that billboard daily. You know, so most people, they didn't have any information, but that's the thing, is you're fishing for information. Luckily for the Kemp family, there were a couple of people that had very, very good information that broke this case open. As I said, the detectives had a feeling that this Teddy Hoover was suspicious. They would find out later on that Teddy Hoover was the name of a friend of Benjamin Appleby's who had died. And his name was Teddy Hoover II. I don't know what he died of or when he died, but this is the person whose identity Benjamin Appleby utilized when he wanted to get away from the police and away from this murder. Also, we've heard it a number of times that killers will go back to the scene of a crime. There have been husbands who killed their wives and then went back and went to the, you know, went with the search parties to go look for their missing wife.
Or the murderers show up at the vigils that are being held for the victims. And when they look at photographs taken, they can pick them out.
Yeah, that's just a scary image right there when you think about it. You're looking at a picture, you know, months or a year later, and they're showing you the killer there at the vigil where all these people are gathered to pay tribute to someone who's been murdered. And there's the killer standing there.
Appleby, he left the scene of the crime. And then he returned. And that's the only reason why they were able to question him. It's because he showed back up. It's weird. I think that he wanted to see what he had done. He wanted to revisit. To me, this isn't a moment of indiscretion and then feeling bad about it. Because you would take off. You would want to distance yourself from the scene of the crime. But he comes back, and I think it was to enjoy his work.
Well, that's a real question, because according to what I read and what was explained by the defense attorney, that people who have intermittent explosive disorder, or IED, that they can feel a tremendous amount of guilt later after whatever they did, whatever violent act they committed. But, I mean, was he just, could he not work up the nerve to talk to the police and say, I did this? Was that why he was there? I don't know that we could know, but the fact that he changed his name and took off and left town after detectives visited him at home, I think that says something. I also find it strange and confusing that it took them a while to figure out his true identity, if they knew where he lived.
Yeah, I feel that the whole situation, they might have been able to press him harder originally, because he was a guy matching the description of the prime suspect. That alone, I've seen people get pulled over and dragged out of their cars and detained for long periods of time. So I don't know why he wasn't, but...
Well, I think it comes down to personal discretion, right? Of the officer. They have tools at their disposal. They have rights at their disposal. But in this case, they were playing it safe. And I think it also demonstrates just how easy a case can go cold. Because if he hadn't shown back up, I don't know. I mean, we could say that the tipsters may have called in still and said, I know that guy, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder if he could have just gotten away with it if he hadn't shown back up. And without that, it just seems like without that name, things could have gotten off to a really rocky start. Allie Kemp's boyfriend at the time felt really bad because he knew that he had missed her call. And when he realized what had happened to her, he thought back and said, I wish that I had been able to catch her call because maybe she was calling for help. I think that's just anybody that has a heart that loves somebody. If they know someone who's in trouble, they will be there for them. And unfortunately for him, he couldn't be there to help Allie. To give you an idea of how popular Allie Kemp was, there were between 1,200 and 1,400 people at her funeral. I mean, I know not everyone can expect a turnout like that, but I think that says something, that so many people came out to her funeral to talk and just to share stories with one another about Allie and her life and her dreams. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.